The way I heard it, we traded places, so if that isn't the case, let me know quickly. But I was supposed to be here the 30th, and I guess he wasn't up to doing it today, so I presume that he's going to take the 30th instead. So it's funny how things happen sometimes. A simple little thing like a letter came in my mailbox last Monday. And a fellow wrote to me with a question, something we've been corresponding on for some time, but he wrote to me with a question, and it was something I was sort of interested in pursuing further with him, so I wrote him a letter back. It turned out to be about 4 pages, and as I was finishing that up, I said, boy, this letter is almost an article in itself. So I said, well, why not? And I dropped it into the article format that I have in my computer and tweaked the introduction a little bit, and suddenly I had an article that I never planned to write. And about as I was getting that finished, Coy calls me on Thursday night and says, do you happen to have anything ready? And I said, well, actually, yeah, I do. Wasn't planning on it. And this isn't the subject that I wanted to cover in 2 weeks. I had another subject that I'm working on, and I'll keep that for next time, I suppose. But it was this particular subject, and I've had my mind on it all week long, so I suppose this ought to be what we talk about today. Something that we have discussed to some degree in the past. Some of this may be repetitious, but I hope there's a good segment of this that'll be new, because when you shake truth together with other truths, they mutually amplify and enhance one another. And I think that's important, that we not only understand things that are biblically accurate, but also place them together, because God's truth is in fact a structured network where one truth enhances and supports and amplifies another. And you can understand certain things in the context of other things. And this particular subject is one of those. In Hebrews chapter 6, we are given what I think we ought to take serious regard for. We are given the outline of the fundamental doctrines of the New Testament church. Very simple little phrase here. It's just 2 verses long. I'm sorry, wrong place. Get the right one here. Hebrews chapter 6. Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, he calls these things the doctrine of Christ, notice, let us go on unto perfection. And we realize that that term perfection is also one of the 7 doctrines that he's presenting here. Not laying again the foundation of repentance from dead works, that's one, and of faith towards God, that's another, of the doctrine of baptisms, that's another, and of laying on of hands, and of the resurrection of the dead, and of eternal judgment. So right there in those short sentences, we have the basic outline, the basic framework of the fundamental doctrines of the Church of God. The doctrine of Christ, it calls it. These elements are important. Now you can notice some of the things that it doesn't mention, and some of those things are things that people have over the years made major issues that perhaps shouldn't be. These are the fundamentals around which everything else that we understand is built. And one of them is the doctrine of the resurrections from the dead. Now, the Apostle Paul made it very clear that this subject is essential to our salvation. Where he says that if there is no resurrection from the dead, you are of all people most miserable. If there is no resurrection from the dead, we have no hope. Now, that's a pretty incredible thing to consider. the resurrections are that important. But mainstream religions, as we know it, generally downplay this subject. And when you consider their theology, you realize they sort of have to downplay it. Because they, in the second century, maybe even earlier than that, this was an old idea that went back 600 or 700 years B.C., but in about the second century, the church took on a teaching that forced Christianity from that point on to put the subject of the resurrections into a lesser regard. I happen to come out of a church that basically had no need for a resurrection, no use for one. That was the Baptists. Now, they acknowledged that there was one, because they had to. The scriptures are very clear on that. It talks about the resurrections in a lot of places, which we're going to do in a minute. But really, when you think about their theology, they don't really have any need for the resurrections from the dead. Why would you need that? People die, and they go to heaven, it seems. And a few others go to that other place, but that's their teaching. That doesn't come from the Bible. They think it does, and they have their favorite verses that they think suggest such a thing. But when you have people dying and going to their reward immediately at death, what further need is there of a resurrection? Why would that be a major and important doctrine of the church? Especially when you understand that the purpose of the resurrection is to bring people back to life in order that they appear before the judgment seat of God to receive their reward. Well, to receive it what? Again? Didn't they already receive it? I mean, people have died for hundreds and thousands of years. And they supposedly went on to their reward at death. And now they're going to be raised from the dead for what purpose? To be reassigned? What about that guy that comes up and before judgment they realize, hey, you shouldn't have been there. You should have been in that other place. You've been in the wrong place already. What is the purpose? You see the problem. You see there's a complication. And what is the purpose of the resurrections from the dead with that kind of theology? And yet it's a major idea that permeates the Christian world. They have a problem with this basic fundamental doctrine. Somehow they have to admit it's there, but when you pin it down or when you look into the matter closely, you have to wonder, what would it possibly be for? There are a great number of places in the New Testament that talk about this subject. We're going to look at just a few of them, but they are major places. It's not just mentioned in passing. It is mentioned specifically. And the situation is described in great detail. There is to be, on major occasions, a resurrection from the dead. Now, we know about that, and we are certain that there's going to be more than one, and it's very obvious in Revelation chapter 20, verse 5. And this is talking about the first resurrection. You can read it from the beginning of the chapter if you want. I'll count on your familiarity with that and just go to verse 5. But it says, the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Now, for there to be a first, there has to be at least one other. You wouldn't say the first if it were the only. So we've got one resurrection, and we know there's going to be at least one other, and there's a 1,000 years blank in between. There are no other resurrections within that span of 1,000 years. So this is a fundamental piece of information that we're given to start with, that there is more than one. And now the Protestants really have a problem. I mean, they accommodate one, because they have to, not really able to explain exactly what it's for, but now we've got another one that we know of. What are these for? And that's basically the question. Not only how many are there, but what are these for? What is it all about? Well, in studying this week, it occurred to me, and it's something I kind of have known, and I think you probably do as well, but maybe we haven't thought about it, but let's think about it. When we understand the biblical holy days, we basically understand the subject of the resurrections. I don't know if you've noticed that. But every holy day season is bracketed by a resurrection. Did you ever notice that? The fall holy days, for example, begins with the Feast of Trumpets. What does that picture? It pictures Christ's return, His second coming. But at that same occasion is when the first resurrection takes place. And then in this verse that we just read, it talks about there being another resurrection at the end of the 1,000 years. So the millennial era begins with the first resurrection, and it ends with the next. But then in the end of the fall holy days, the last great day. The last great day is that span of time that we understand to be the great judgment period, and I'll get into that in more detail in a minute. But it also begins with the resurrection at the end of 1,000 years, and it ends with another resurrection that occurs at what we call the Great White Throne. And there's a great deal of detail on that. I'm going to go through the scriptures in a minute. I'm just laying down an outline for you to think about as we read these scriptures, because once we understand the framework, these fall into place. And we should be very familiar with these subjects. I don't think I'm going to throw anything at you that's new, or I'm not going to present a scripture that you probably haven't been familiarized with. But once we understand where it's going and where it fits, this subject jumps alive. Now, the spring holy days, same thing. It begins with a resurrection, did you notice? And it ends with one. The spring holy day season begins with the Passover season, the resurrection of the first fruits, Christ's resurrection. Our salvation is impossible had there been no resurrection of Jesus Christ. Where is it? Is it in 1 Corinthians 15 that says that? If there be no resurrection, we are all people most miserable. We have no hope, in other words. All of the trials that we go through are pointless unless there is the hope that comes to us by means of the resurrection from the dead. But the spring holy days even begin with the resurrection of the first fruits, and it ends with the resurrection of the rest of the first fruits, the resurrection that is pictured in the day of Pentecost. Not only being given the Spirit at the beginning of the church era, but being made Spirit at the end of it. So the spring holy days are also bracketed by a resurrection. So with that framework in mind, let's look at some scriptures, because Jesus Christ was not unclear on this subject. And it's Matthew, John 5, I'm sorry, no wonder. John 5. Okay, it's up in about verse 24. It's where it begins. There's a very lengthy passage here where he describes the resurrections from the dead. And notice I put that in the plural. Verse 24, "Truly I say unto you, he that hears my word and believes on him that sent me has everlasting life, and shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death into life." Now that's one category of person. If you read through this passage very carefully, you realize that he's talking about more than one situation. These in verse 24 are those who are already passed from condemnation, who are already assigned to life. They don't need to come to an end time final sentencing. Their situation is already described. And then he breaks the subject again, and notice it starts with verily, verily again. And here he begins to talk about another category of person. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. Now the statement, they that hear, suggests that some will and some won't. Now you can say, well, that's really picking at straws. Well, from just this place, yes. But when we compare it to another place, we're going to realize that no, that is not a minor detail at all. There are some who are going to experience a resurrection at a particular point in time that will hear when others won't. Not all will hear. And then in verse 26, it continues the subject. For as the Father has given in himself, hath given life in himself, so has he given to the Son to have life in himself, and has given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. At this particular resurrection, he is going to, notice, not condemn, but to give life. There's a lot of detail in here, but you have to think about it, you have to meditate on it. And when we overlay the other place that Jesus Christ described these same resurrections, we're going to see the detail jump out drastically off the page. And then in verse 28, he says, marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in the which all. Now, up in the previous one, it wasn't all. It was only those who hear. But in this one, it's all who are in their graves shall hear his voice, and shall come forth, they that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. This resurrection is a resurrection of sentencing. It's either life or condemnation at this point in time. So we have here a picture of more than one resurrection, and it seems to be three. First are those who go straight to life. They bypass condemnation. They bypass the throne. They're already passed. They're already regarded as being in an alive state, ready for the first resurrection. And we'll see in another place, the first resurrection only involves God's true saints, where we read earlier in Revelation 20, verse 5. That the rest of the dead live not again till the 1,000 years were finished. Those who are in the first resurrection are the saints of God who will rule with him for those 1,000 years. And even from that, we can begin to see the overlay between the subject of the doctrine of the resurrections and the teaching regarding the biblical holy days. There is a resurrection that involves all of God's true saints. Then there is a blank period of 1,000 years when there are no more, and after the 1,000 years, there's another resurrection. And that's when those who do hear come up. Now, there's another place that Jesus Christ personally gave an account of these resurrections through the same man, by the way, the Apostle John, 60 years later. And that place is Revelation 20. And we read that a few minutes ago. Let's just skim this chapter a little bit to get the context. Verse 1, "And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit, and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. Verse 4, "And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. That's that same 1,000 years that Satan is bound. That's that same 1,000-year blank between those two resurrections that verse 5 talks about, which we just read. The rest of the dead lived not again till the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. A very important piece of information. By this time, John especially, and I presume the church also, had come to correctly understand the resurrections. What Jesus Christ gave to them back in John 5, he had to preface it with, "Assuredly I say unto you." He said that twice. And then the final one, he says, "Marvel not," because they would have marveled. He was giving them at that point in time something that they didn't know before. New truth. An expansion of a doctrine. I mean, the Old Testament religion did believe in a resurrection. It did not understand that there is to be more than one. But he was expanding the subject for them. He wanted them to know, and he knew that they would be aghast with what they were hearing, because it was different. But he was presenting to the fact that there was more than one. But here in the account that he gives to John, the same man, in Revelation 20, he doesn't preface it with the marvel nots or anything like that, because I think they were coming to understand the subject by that point in time. This was more than 50 years later when these words were written. Same subject, though. But notice, let's go through this. Verse 7, "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison," and that's just for a brief time. Over in verse 11, "And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works." And then in verse 13, "And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every man, according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire." This is the second death. "And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire." Now here again, like we saw in John 5, we again see multiple situations. Verse 6, "Blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection, on such the second death has no power." These who come up in the first resurrection are exempt from any chance of being condemned. They are already predestined to life from which there is no loss. They're exempt from what the rest are going to have to go through. Notice that. The rest are going to be subject to what we see further down. Verse 11, "The great white throne." Verse 12, "And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God." But here's an interesting detail. And overlay this with what we read earlier in John 5. The dead, small and great, and this is people of low stature or people of great prominence in the society in which they lived. The dead, small and great, stand before God, and what happens? The books were opened. And we understand that that word books is from the Greek biblion, a collection of books. That's what you have right there laying in your laps, a collection of books, biblion. Those books are going to be opened to people's understanding, to the degree that they are not today, many people are blinded deliberately by God. Imagine that. I mean, that's a hard thing to consider. But that's what the Scriptures plainly say. Consider, for example, John 6:44. No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. The Apostle Paul affirmed the same thing. Israel has not obtained that which he seeks for, but the election has obtained it, and the rest were blinded. According as it is written, God has given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear unto this day. And that's Romans chapter 11, verses 7 and 8, quoting Isaiah 29, verse 10. How do we understand that? God has blinded the eyes of some people, even Israel? Let's remember that Israel of the Old Testament era, and for that matter, those in Christ's day who lived with him, were not converted. A few were, a few that God the Father chose to call at that time, but the rest were not. And we have to ask why. Later in that same chapter, Romans 11, verses 25 and 26, the Apostle Paul gives us the answer. He says, "For I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in." And that brings us down to the very end time. "And so all Israel shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob." God has blinded the eyes of a vast number of people for one basic reason. And it's the same reason that exists among most people in the world. Most people are so superficial. They may be overtly religious. They may look very religious. But we tend to be superficial. And no less so the Jewish people of Christ's day. He blinded them for a specific reason. And it says here why. So that all would have a better opportunity. God has blinded them so that they wouldn't blow their chance early. He knew who he could call. He knew who would make it. And that could explain why so few in this world ever show the interest in the things of God. God has blinded them to protect their period of opportunity. And their opportunity will come in an era that is far more amenable to success than the society, the rotten, deceived society in which we live today. We know that when someone comes into the truth, there is, for the most part, and even people who aren't religious in the past, we know it's a massive job to retrain them into God's truth because there is so much out there that's not the truth. But God has blinded them with the specific purpose of giving them an opportunity at a point in time when they have a greater chance of success. And that's the reason for it. Now, I've been talking around a particular era of time, and I think we ought to get specific on that right now, and that is the era when the books are opened to them, because that blindness is going to fall away. They're going to have an opportunity. Now, Jesus Christ, personally, of all people, wrote more about this subject, or spoke more about this subject, than any other New Testament writer. Jesus Christ wanted us to know that there is a period of time coming when the books are going to be opened to people's awareness. And that's that resurrection that occurs after the 1,000 years. The church has understood that resurrection to be physical, It has understood that resurrection to represent a period of opportunity, not of sentencing. Sentencing comes later, but it's a period of opportunity for those who died never having had opportunity. Consider, there are vast pagan societies back through to the flood practically that never knew the truth. They were never exposed to it. They were never evangelized. Even today, there's tribes of people on earth that have never had a reasonable opportunity to know the truths. There's those that die in infancy. What about them? That's a problem that many churches struggle with. The Mormons opposed an answer. The Catholics opposed an answer to that. And I heard one of the prominent Protestant speakers, I forget which one, might have been Hal Lindsey even, referring to the tsunami where so many young children were killed. He was suggesting that those that were under a certain age all went to heaven anyway, even though they're Muslim, which is an interesting thought. You see, they recognize the question, but they don't have the answer. And they don't have the answer because they accepted a faulty premise back in the second century, which disregards this particular subject. It doesn't allow the resurrections from the dead to be taught as it's in the Bible. And hopefully I can make that clear enough today to you. But Jesus Christ spoke of this point in time. And that's where I would like to go next. He spoke of this rather often. Matthew chapter 12, verses 41 and 42. And this repeats another one in Luke 11, 31. You could go to either place. It reads about the same. But Matthew 12, 41 and 2. I'll start in verse 39. But he answered and said unto them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and there shall be no sign given to it, but the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh shall rise in judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, a greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. Now think about that picture. Here he's talking about people who lived in very different ages from one another. The time of Jonah, the time of Solomon, the generation of that day to whom he was speaking. He's saying that all of those will be raised up together. And when we understand judgment to be a period of evaluation, not sentencing necessarily, and that should be another topic maybe we should cover, that judgment is not strictly condemnation. Judgment has come upon the church of God, it says, I think it's in James. This is the day the church is being judged, because this is the day the church is being called. But it isn't judgment in the sense of condemnation, it's a judgment in the sense of evaluation. Any jury trial, there's a period of time where you hear the evidence. You haven't come to a sentence yet. And they deliberate that evidence after the trial. And then they come to a sentence. The whole process is judgment in a sense. But the hearing of the evidence is as much a part of the judgment process as is the sentencing. We tend to go right straight to the idea of sentencing when we see the word judgment, but it's not always the case. There is a period of time when these people are going to come into judgment. Now, here are people that live centuries apart. They're not brought up as spirit beings, they're brought up still physical. But it says that one generation is going to look at the other generation. It's going to have enough time and enough interface with them to get to know what their history was. So there's got to be some time there. And they're going to realize that, boy, if our generation had what your generation had, we would have responded. Why didn't you? It's going to rise up in judgment with this generation and shall condemn it. For she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Behold, a greater than Solomon is here. So people over vast amounts of time are going to be raised physical. They're going to get to know one another. They're going to get to know what the others knew and are going to be critical of one another. Do you see the picture of what Jesus Christ is talking about here? Back up just a chapter in 11. Chapter 11, verse 20. Here's more of this. And this is Jesus Christ himself talking about the subject of the resurrections from the dead. Because those people came up out of their graves, again restored to consciousness. Then began he, this is verse 20 of chapter 11, then began he to upbraid the cities wherein most of his mighty works were done, because they didn't respond as they should have. Woe unto you, Chorazin! Woe unto you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the day of judgment than for you. Now think about that. If judgment meant consignment to the lake of fire, how could that be more tolerable for one than for the other? Wouldn't it be equal? Do you see what he's saying there? He's saying that there is to be a judgment process where some are going to find themselves in a better situation. Catch the sense of what he's saying. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, which are exalted unto the heavens. This is the Malibu of the day. This is the place where everybody wanted to be. This is where all the people who were anything were living. Capernaum, which are exalted unto the heavens, shall be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which have been done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. He's saying, if Sodom had the chance you had, it would have been a better place than you. But I say unto you that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. How could it be more tolerable if judgment were a consistent thing? No, there is some evaluation going on here where one is provided a different destiny. So you can catch the sense of what Jesus Christ is talking about. He's talking about that resurrection back to a physical state. And it's that state that we read of in Revelation 21, that middle state that he talks about, where the books are opened to them, where they are then allowed to understand the biblical truths that we understand. They are allowed access to God's Spirit, which is denied them so long as they're blinded. That's the first thing that God's Spirit does, is opens our eyes. So we can see the implications there. So there's some very powerful information here that supports the idea of a physical resurrection to opportunity. And that's what we understand about the last great day. It begins with this resurrection, and it ends with that other that Jesus Christ talks about in at least three places that I'm going to give to you. There is another resurrection where the sheep are separated from the goats, where the wheat is separated from the tares, where one angel goes out and reaps the harvest of God's future kingdom, the product of God's future kingdom, the produce that came from that. And another angel right behind him that reaps the grapes destined for God's vat of wrath. Let's look at that one first. That's in Revelation, I believe, about chapter 21. No, Revelation 14. I'm sorry, Revelation 14. 21 is another thing. Just to get the picture of where we are, I'll start with verse 1. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. Verse 4, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. Remember, we talked about the first fruits. Those that come up in the harvest that's represented by the day of Pentecost. Again, an allusion to the first resurrection. And then further down, he talks about, actually, these are the pronouncements that establish the kingdom of God. Verse 6, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. This is the point in time when that veil is to be removed from their understanding, when the books are to be opened to them. The everlasting gospel is going to be preached to them at this point in time. And these are the survivors who live over into the millennial age, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and all the fountains of waters. It's saying basically, worship the Creator. How do you worship the Creator? By honoring his Sabbath day. I'll skip down here. This is talking about Babylon falling. It's talking about pronouncements against worshiping the beast any further. Talking about wrath against those people who do. Verse 11, the smoke of their torment ascends up. And then in verse 12, something very interesting. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. In other words, he's summing up the overall picture of our hope. We can be assured that the world order as we know it and everything that's wrong about it is going to be corrected in the establishment of the kingdom of God. And we see in these previous four or five verses the basic parameters of the establishment of the kingdom of God. Worship God. Don't worship Satan anymore. Here's the patience of the saints, it says. But then notice, verse 13, very interesting. Because this is after the first resurrection. This is as the millennial age is beginning. There are still physical people left alive, ruled over by spirit-born saints of God who rule with him on the earth, as it says in other places. But in verse 13 it says, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, yea, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. So after the first resurrection, physical people are going to continue dying. They're going to live a normal life, just basically as we do today, in a different society. But there are people who are going to die after that point in time. Are they going to all die, all converted? Or are they going to die, some converted and some not? And that question is answered further. Here in the same chapter. This verse 13 is in between two separate subjects. One, prior to verse 13, is the establishment of the kingdom of God and the saints of God realizing their ultimate hope. But in verse 14, it begins to describe what the title at the top of my page says, the harvests of the world. In verse 14, and I looked and behold a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple crying with a loud voice, and the earth was reaped. Jesus Christ himself is going to reap that first group of people. And then verse 17, and another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And that other angel came out from the altar which had power over fire and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And that angel thrust in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. We have two harvests occurring here at the same time. This is the final sentencing that we see in the general resurrection, which is at the very end of human experience on earth. There is the first resurrection of saints. There is a resurrection of opportunity for those who died who never had an opportunity at the end of the 1,000 years. And at the end of probably one more generation, we see a sentencing where the evil and the good are brought up together. They are separated from one another. And they are assigned to their ultimate destinies, be it good or bad, at that point in time. You know the story about the description that Jesus Christ gave of the occasion when the sheep and the goats are separated. We know the story about when the tares and the wheat, which are allowed to grow together, notice, are bound separately. The angels are the reapers, it says. And they are separated. And the wheat is taken into God's barn, and the tares are taken off and burned. Jesus Christ himself gave those illustrations. And he wants us to get the picture that there is a resurrection when the righteous and unrighteous are going to be brought up together as a single crowd of people. And when they are going to be separated out from one another. And those who are Christ's are going to be brought into his family and his kingdom. And those who ultimately have rejected the call of God are going to be consigned to the lake of fire. That can't be the second resurrection as we understand it. That has to be a third. We see those people who live during the millennial age and who die. They're not going to live for any 1,000 years. They're going to live a normal lifespan. And they're going to go to their graves just as now. And they're going to await a resurrection then just as now. It's a different resurrection. It's not the first one. It's not as high an honor as the first resurrection. But it's a resurrection to life or a resurrection to condemnation, depending on the person's works, as it says. Every man will be judged according to his works shall be. Those people will grow up and live in the millennial age and the post-millennial age, one more generation that is illustrated by the last great day. And at the end of the last great day, there is going to be a final sentencing where the good and bad are brought up together and are separated out by the angels and harvested for either destination. Now, when you think it through and when you think of the holy days and what they mean and what they picture, you have to realize that the doctrine of the resurrections from the dead dovetails with and fits into that picture so beautifully. And it's almost impossible to understand one fully without the other. So these are mutually supporting pictures, representations that God has given to us. What Colossians 2 calls the holy days, it refers to them as a shadow of things to come. Or in other words, modern English, a prophetic outline. The holy days are a prophetic outline. That's basically what Paul wrote of them. Religion loves to use that verse as a reason to reject the holy days, which is incredible when you read what it's saying. But they are a prophetic outline. We understand that. We've come to know that by practice and by by being taught about them. But the world's religions are compelled to reject them. And I think part of the reason is because they raise disturbing questions about modern-day mainstream theology. How do you accommodate the resurrections from the dead? How do you accommodate what Jesus Christ said about those people from various ancient generations who are going to be brought up together and are going to get to know one another and are going to know what one another knew and had opportunity to know and say, boy, I wish we had that. Who are going to live through that whole new world order, the millennial age, and are going to have the opportunity wide open to them. That time, that period of time, is that period referred to in Revelation 21 that's called whosoever will may come. Because it will no longer be the Father's specific call that a person is allowed to come to an understanding of the truth. At that point in time, it will be up to the individual. Wide open door of salvation. And it's a matter of simply the person deciding what he's going to do and bearing the consequence for his decision. But there is a period of time when those people who never had a chance are going to be raised and given an opportunity that they never had. And that's the most important thing we need to understand, because it allows us to better understand the whole subject, not only of the holy days, but of the resurrections. Opportunity for those who never had opportunity. And it's a priceless piece of information. Jesus Christ spoke often about it. He spoke in length, in detail about it. But you don't hear that much on the Inspiration Network or on the Trinity Network. They just don't present this subject. Simple reason why. They've got to revise their theology to accommodate it. Now, we understand it. It's a gift that we've been given. And we understand it because we have decided, and rightfully so, to reject certain elements of fundamental Christian theology so that the truth of God can come through to the surface. And one of the major truths is the doctrine of Christ, the doctrine of the resurrections from the dead. And if you'll notice in that place that we read in Hebrews 6, the last one mentioned, and of eternal judgment. We can't really come to fully understand the mechanics of eternal judgment either without understanding the resurrections from the dead. So it's an important doctrine. And it's one that we need to rejoice in, that we have a subject that we can understand in greater depth than any other religious organization has ever been able to understand. And I won't fault them for what they have, but I will fault them for what they don't have. They've put themselves in a position where they have to reject certain fundamental truths. The subject of salvation, not only for us, but of the rest of the world, hinges on understanding the resurrections. Our ability to understand the holy days is very much dependent upon our ability, or our depth of understanding, of the subject of the resurrections. How the kingdom is going to work is related to, and very much dependent upon, the resurrections from the dead. Eternal judgment. Just judgment. They're all tied together in this particular subject. That's why it is a fundamental doctrine of the church. The resurrections from the dead. Blindness prevents certain people from understanding now. And God, in a way, is being merciful to them because he knows that certain people couldn't respond right now. They're either locked into certain predicaments or they have such an attitude or a mindset where the best they could hope for probably is to be somebody like Cain, religious but far from righteous. It's a fact of life. we would love for those that we know and love to be brought to the truth as we have been. But let's be realistic. And from what we understand here, God has a better plan for those. It's unfortunate they're going to miss a lot of years, but He has a plan to provide them with an opportunity. Not saying that they're going to make it then either, but it's certainly going to be easier, and a far greater number will. So God has a plan for mankind. He knows how we work. To some degree, hopefully, we are gathering how He works. But God will ultimately allow every person who was ever born to have the opportunity for life, as we do. So we can rejoice in that. But we need to understand that there is a resurrection in between the first one and the last one. The first one being for the saints, the last one being for the separation of the righteous from the wicked in a mass scale. Oh, there's one verse I didn't get to, and I'd like to go there. It's back in Revelation 20. One little phrase that I didn't point out that I think is very, very insightful. And it has everything to do with this. But Revelation 20. It's in verse 11. And I saw a great white throne, and Him that sat on it, and from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away. And it says, and there was found no place for them. The dead, small and great, verse 12. There was found no place for them. What, is the universe too small? I mean, the earth itself right now is containing the graves of all who ever lived and all who are alive today. The earth is big enough for that. How could there be no place for them? And when we understand this, this is not a spatial thing. These people, at this point in time, who are coming up before this great white throne, the just God could not justly assign them to either destiny because such a thing had not yet been determined. Do you see what we have there? God can't rightfully consign them to either destiny. Their judgment period hadn't been carried out yet. That's why there's no place for them. He can't send them to either place. It isn't a spatial thing. It isn't the lack of space. I mean, look, we've got vast numbers of people described later that don't seem to have a space problem. The innumerable multitude, they don't have a space problem. It's not space. It's a simple fact that they have not yet completed their opportunity period. Therefore, they can't be assigned. And that's another interesting detail. But Jesus Christ gave us a great deal about this subject. And I think we ought to take it seriously and we ought to appreciate what we have. That it's unique in this world. And let's rejoice in it. Now, if any of you want to pursue this further, there are a couple of articles in the back. In fact, it's the one that I was referring to when I started. The one that resulted from that fellow's letter that I wrote this week. But it's the one on the three resurrections. And then there's another one with it that talks about a shadow of things to come, which gives you the holy day side of this same subject that I've sort of tied the two together at this point. But if you want to study it further, take those and look at it at length. There's more information in there, perhaps, than what I've given you here orally, but let's appreciate what we have, because it certainly is priceless.